Are you recording? I didn't get any. There we go. Okay. Thank you. Well, good afternoon, everyone. This is Wednesday, September 17th, 2025. And this is a collective bargaining session between the team from the United Faculty of Florida at UCF and the team representing the UCF Board of Trustees. Charlie, do you have the minutes from our August 27th meeting?
Hold on a second. Having some other problem. Okay, that's not it. There we go.
I'm good with the minutes if everyone else is good.
It's fine.
All right. Thank you very much. All right. The first thing that we want to do this afternoon is talk about our response to your proposed Article 23. And I want to begin, first of all, by just thanking you for your patience as the university has sorted through all the financial information, budgets, and so on, in order to be able to make a response. One of the things that you're probably aware of from this particular budget year for fiscal year 26, UCF did not receive any additional unrestricted recurring funds for this year. Those funds, the unrestricted recurring funds, are very important when we start talking about things like increases in salary. A lot of effort went into seeing what might be able to be done with increases to base, and we're not going to be proposing an increase to base this afternoon. The university's leadership team has identified some one-time funds that we're going to propose as one-time payments. The funds that are being used on campus, and this is what's being proposed here for the in-unit faculty and other employees as well, actually exceed the new allocation of unrestricted one-time funds that the university received. So what the provost and the CFO and the president will be doing is, in order to get everything back into balance, there'll have to be some other decisions that are made. Some planned activities may not be able to take place. As you know, we've been talking about this for a couple of years. UCF is committed to achieving preeminent status in the state of Florida. And thanks to the efforts of the faculty and other employees, many other employees, all other employees across our campus, some very good progress has been made toward preeminence. And I know that I speak for the entire leadership team when I say thank you to all our faculty and the other employees who have moved us much closer to this preeminent status. The attainment of preeminent status is really essential to us being able to offer what I'll call healthy increases to salaries. And it's imperative that when UCF achieves preeminence, and hopefully that's not too far into the future, that the preeminent funding that we receive is recurring funding, and as much of it as possible is unrestricted. That's what really gives the university leadership an opportunity to make decisions here locally about how that money is going to be spent. You may be aware that for fiscal year 26 this year, the preeminent institutions only received one-time funding rather than the recurring funding that they've typically received as preeminent institutions. And that has had a big impact around the state. For example, FIU had come to terms last year with a three-year salary package with the faculty. And in fact, it was a very attractive agreement that they had for 3 years. And the leadership at FIU has notified the union there that negotiations have to be reopened on their salaries article, the one that they thought was good for 3 years, because FIU did not get the additional recurring funds that they had hoped to get. I've talked to folks at other institutions as well, and there are other institutions that are already preeminent that are looking at increases this year, but increases that are considerably less than the increases that they've offered in previous years. So I think it's fair to say that in the state of Florida, things are very tight. There's not a lot of new recurring money that's going to institutions. UCF got none. And there were institutions like FIU that were counting on additional recurring money that didn't happen. So I wanted to share that with you in the way of background as I get ready to actually show you what we're proposing for Article 23. And in a communication I had yesterday with Robert and Talat, I described this as very modest. And I know when you see some of this, you may use a different term to refer to it, but it certainly is very modest. And it is what it is. We're showing you what is available. So Charlie, can you begin to display Article 23? And can we go down to starting in line 17?
Sorry, can you clarify one thing quick?
Absolutely.
Chuck, before you get started. So the draft you're working from is from a status quo from a previous, or is this from what we gave you?
The status quo.
Yes, okay. Yes, Robert. Status quo. Okay, and then beginning in line 17, we address what's going to happen for 25-26. We're striking a line that we added last year in the full book to cover the 23-24 academic year. And in what is now paragraph A, we're talking about the one-time payment that we're proposing for 2025-2026, this current academic year. And what we're proposing is that a one-time payment become effective on Friday, November 21st of this year, to be paid out on Friday, December 12th of this year. So we're just making some modifications to the status quo version of Article 23. To receive this one-time payment, employees have to have been in a continual non-OPS employment relationship with the university at the end of the last academic year, so their employees continuing into the present academic year. Their annual evaluations were satisfactory or above for 24-25. And they are still employed at the university in an in-unit position at the date of implementation. So that would be November 21st of this year. And if there are people who did not receive an annual evaluation for last year, they will be considered having received a satisfactory evaluation. So that's pretty standard. And then the one-time payment amounts are shown in the table here. And I'm going to ask Charlie for clarity just to get rid of the markup so we can see what it looks like. But what's being proposed right now is those with salaries under $125,000 would receive a one-time payment of $1,500. Those with salaries of $125,000 or more would receive a one-time payment of $1,000. And I wanted to make sure that that table could be viewed clearly, because with the markup in it, it's a little bit more challenging to read it. So that's what the proposed one-time payments would look like. And Charlie, can we go back to the markup and then continue forward in this article? So we had a paragraph about merit salary increases for last year. We're updating the heading on that and mentioning that there are no merit salary increases for 25-26. In the next section, 23.4, we are adding some additional languages, is really clarifying how these one-time payments and salary increases are handled for C&G and auxiliary employees. And essentially the money has to be available in the funds that are supporting those positions, or in the accounts supporting those positions. And that's what we've always done. This is just us trying to make that more clear right now. As we get to 23.5, we've dealt with post-tenure review. Last year, we had an extra paragraph that we put in here because we actually worked backwards a year, because we had people that went through the post-tenure review process in 23-24, and there was no remuneration for that. And we took care of the people who went through post-tenure review in 23-24 and 24-25 last year. But we only need the second paragraph going forward that says, you know, our plan is to continue to make payments of either $5,500 or $2,500 to people who exceed or meet expectations. Those payments would be effective 3 weeks before the first pay date in May and distributed on the first pay date in May. At the end of that paragraph, we give an example of what this would look like for the current academic year. The effective date of the payments would be April 10th, and the date of the distribution of the one-time payments would be May 1st of 2026. And then as we begin to take a quick look at section 23.6, where we cover our incentive award program, one thing that really distinguishes UCF from other institutions in the state is that we have these incentive awards, and the university commits $575,000 of one-time funds and $575,000 additional recurring funds each year for these incentive awards. And that makes us very unique in the state of Florida. Charlie, can we go to line 122? There's a change that we're proposing there. We were actually pointing to the wrong section of this article. We were pointing to section E. It should have been section D. It's D1J is where we want to direct people. So we're just trying to correct that mistake there. And then beginning in 175, thank you. There have been some changes to the administrative structure of the institution. For example, there's no longer a College of Undergraduate Studies. The School of Modeling, Simulation, and Training, which had been under the College of Graduate Studies, has been moved to the College of Engineering and Computer Science. So, we want to take a look at the incentive awards that we had that went to people that we sometimes referred to as those in the other college. It wasn't a formal college. There wasn't a dean. And now that the College of Undergraduate Studies no longer exists at UCF, and the College of Graduate Studies no longer houses full-time faculty, except in their administrative roles, this other college now would become just the institutes and centers. And that's what this clarifies here. And as a result, without teaching faculty, what is proposed here is that one RIA award would be available to this other college that would really consist of people from the institutes and centers. And that would mean, we've got a comment in there, that would mean that there would be no TIP awards allocated to the centers and institutes. The TIP awards would all go to the other more traditional colleges. And then in 185, something that we wanted to clarify, the process that is outlined in the CBA, the process that we have agreed to for evaluating applications for the TIP and RIA awards, indicate that the college committees are going to evaluate these awards and, first of all, determine how many applicants they think are truly worthy of either a TIP or a RIA award. And that number that they say are worthy for such an award may be smaller than the number of awards that are available. It may be larger than the number of awards that are available. What we have tried to encourage folks to do is make sure that you rank as many candidates that you think are eligible for a TIP, as many candidates that you think are eligible for a RIA as possible. And when we get to point J, that's important, because it could be that in some colleges somebody applies for a TIP and a RIA, and we agreed last year that faculty could only win either a TIP or a RIA, but not both, in the same academic year. If someone were to apply for both and be judged worthy to receive both, they would have to make a selection, either to accept the TIP award or the RIA award in that particular year, and then they could apply again the following year for whichever one they did not get. But we want to point out that if this happens, if there is somebody that is tagged for potentially two of these awards and they have to forego one of them because they can't win both, it's possible, if there weren't more people ranked in that college, that an award would go unclaimed. It wouldn't be assigned to anybody. So I wanted to take this as an opportunity to remind everyone that it's important that the committees rank everybody that they think is really worthy of an award, even if it turns out they end up ranking more applications than they have awards. And then I guess the last thing we have is in lines 304 and 305. We're just updating the information about the ADIs, that the key date would now be people that were in an employment relationship with UCF by May 7th of 2025. And I believe that is all the changes that we are proposing for Article 23. And Robert, I'm sure you have some questions. I'm sure you may have some things to say, and we would like to hear from you.
Yeah, I think I agree with you. I don't think, what was the term you used, meager? I don't think I would use meager on this. I would use another word.
I said very modest, but
modest. I would not use modest. If there's something below modest, a lot below modest, I might use that word. I'm kind of curious about, if you can go back up on, could back up on the screen. If you could walk me through, go not to the ADI, but the one previous to that, the revisions previous to the ADI.
This is on the TIP and RIA?
Yeah, the selection of the committee. Can you walk us through that? Because I was a little confused at your explanation. So exactly.
Okay.
What? Yeah, like what? What does the committee get? What does the committee determine and all of this?
What the committee is supposed to get is all the applicants in their college. So they've got, but let's just say it's a TIP committee. So they've got information about all the people that have applied for TIP. Let's assume everybody's turned in all the things that they're supposed to turn in for a TIP application. All the TIP applications are complete. What is specified here in the CBA is that committee is supposed to, each committee member is supposed to rank as many people as they think are deserving of a TIP award. And they may not have information about how many TIP awards there are in that college, but just how many people.
How many applications are
suggestive of someone who is deserving of a TIP award. And then there's a process that's outlined here that I prefer not to go through step by step, but there's a process for the committee to get all that ranking information, pull it together, and come up with a ranked list of candidates for that TIP award. Now, just for the sake of example, suppose that college has 4 TIP awards. If that committee ranks 3 people as worthy of it, then there'll be at least 1 award that goes unclaimed. If there are 6 applications for 4 awards, then presumably the top 4 people on the list will receive a TIP. If it turns out that one of the people that is supposed to get a TIP is also selected for a re-award, they can't accept both in the same year and they have to make a choice. They have to decide, am I going to accept the TIP or the RIA? If they say, I'm going to take the RIA, I'd rather have the RIA award, then that opens up the possibility that a TIP award is now available to another person in that college. And if the dean's been provided a ranked list that includes more names beyond those that were identified initially as the TIP recipients, the dean can select the next person on that list, for example. And that award would then be used anyway. It would just go to, say, the 5th person on the list instead of the 3rd, who had been the 3rd on the list. If the committee only ranks 4 and that award, the person decides instead of a TIP, I'd rather receive a RIA, there's no ranked list for the dean to use to assign that 4th TIP award. So that's why what I'm trying to convey is we think it's important for these committees to rank up front as many people as they think are truly deserving of a TIP, even if it means some of them aren't going to get it. How many of these people deserve it? And there may be situations where one of those awards becomes available. Did I do a better job that time, Robert?
I don't know. I still got a lot of questions. But so how is that different from before? Because when I served on these committees, the lists were always ranked. I don't know what makes this ranking different from previous rankings.
I don't know that it's different. What's different in the full book that we agreed to last year is someone who might be ranked very highly for TIP and ranked very highly for RIA. In the past, they would have gotten both awards. Now we're saying they have to select one.
You know, I understand that part. But I'm still kind of confused on embargoing the number of awards per committee. And it seems like the decision on the number of awards for committee and where awards may or may not go to is still not transparent. in this process. Is that correct?
We did not share the number of awards because, again, we are trying to encourage people to rank mm-hmm. all of the applications that are mm-hmm. deserving of an award. And it can happen that it's helpful to have another name or two on that list. What we found is if colleges were informed, you've got six RIA awards, they rank six people. Mm-hmm. And then if somebody gives up that RIA award, there's nothing the college can do. There's nobody to draw from to replace them.
Mm-hmm. So the answer to my question was yes, right, Chuck?
I don't remember exactly how it was worded, but
I asked you that it's not a transparent process, and that you described a process that is not transparent. So I'm just going to take it as a yes, which is kind of I'm kind of confused about, because again, when I served on RIAs and TIP committees, we ranked people beyond the number of awards. So are you saying that that practice had stopped at some point, and colleges and then the provost office were only getting the rankings up to the number of awards per committee? That's the part I'm kind of confused
yeah,
about.
Experience that I'm aware of is there were colleges that would stop at the number of awards. Mm. What you described is because of your membership on the CA committee, that committee did exactly what it was supposed to do. Here in Article 23, it appears that some colleges elected to simply stop at the number of awards that they were told they had. Mm-hmm. And now that could cause them to lose an award if somebody selected for both a TIP and a RIA.
All right, Talat has her hand up. Why don't we go to her?
And I'm going to get to Talat in one moment. I'd like to say, I want to make this clear. What we're trying to do is make sure we award all the TIPs and all the RIAs. I'm trying to make sure with the language that we're proposing that 115 incentive awards are awarded. And that is more likely to happen if all the colleges rank as many applications as are deserving. That will help. I'm sorry, Talat, please.
So the two things. One is that when we went through this last year, what we were promised is that, yes, the same formula that has been used up to now is still being used. And the only thing that this does, because one individual can take only one award as opposed to two or three that they were able to do in the past, is that basically that these numbers per college will fluctuate by one or two. So the problem that we're having right now is that formula, and since last year when we were talking about it, that we had a new director of faculty excellence, so we didn't push this, but I think that formula should be available. It is the same formula that was used before, and we should really make it, and that would make it transparent. So I think we all understand because I believe the number of awards is related to the number of faculty in that particular unit or college, right? And so we should, and we all understand that number changes as we go on, and also because of this restriction, it will change. So that fluctuation, it will be accounted for. So you won't be able to say, a College of Arts and Humanities has four awards. We can't say that. It could be three, it could be five, it could be, somewhere in that. But just the process by which that initial number is gotten, I think that we should make it very clear, because then I know we had so many questions and this didn't make any sense because we kept saying, no, it's the same formula. But then the question was, what is the formula? So I think we should really make that transparent, what the formula is, with the caveat that number will change. So I think that would help.
There's a couple of things, though, if I may. Mm-hmm. I mean, you're right. From year to year, most colleges, it doesn't change. There were, I think, last year, I think there were two colleges where it changed or something like that. There aren't big changes in these numbers. One college that was impacted the most happened to be the College of Engineering and Computer Science because of a lot of hiring that took place mm-hmm. in that college. There were more people that were potentially eligible for these awards. So hiring patterns, the distribution of faculty across the colleges changes a little bit over time. I've also mentioned today that over the last year, there's been some restructuring of academic units. We no longer have a College of Undergraduate Studies. This other college that we had, the other in quotes, looks different now. The College of Undergraduate Studies isn't in there anymore. The College of Graduate Studies doesn't have faculty that are eligible for these awards either. So that means there are going to be more of those awards that go to the traditional colleges. School of Modeling, Simulation, and Training went to the College of Engineering and Computer Science.
Sure.
That's where they are administratively now. So they're going to, you know, engineering could get more this year than they got.
No, there's no problem.
I don't know.
But, you know, I think, you know, having for that particular year, because this is a moving target, but for this year, coming year, for example, a rough idea of how many awards there would be per college is still makes it transparent, given that, you know, that number is not going to be, it can fluctuate. But I think what doesn't make it transparent is if people have no idea and then they don't know what formula is being used. So if we have that is the formula, and this now engineering has this many faculty, arts and humanities has this many, and this, those are facts and figures that are there on UCF's website. And so people can go and say, okay, roughly we expect, you know, 3 awards in this college, 10 awards in this other college. I think that just makes it a lot more transparent than saying we don't know. I think that's my thing. But I'm actually going to ask you a few other questions because I'm, you know, obviously, I'm sure you recognize them. I'm very disappointed with what you have to offer here. And I would like a few questions because I do have knowledge of what has been offered at each of the other institutions in the Florida system. And we can go over the details another time, but I am aware of that, and this doesn't even get there. So you know, we are, you know, I like that German word to say Ausnahme. You know, we are an exception, but Ausnahme is actually even more suggestive of it. Okay, so we are really an exception in the Florida State University system. So I have a couple of questions. One is that could we get from you the number of new faculty that we have hired college-wise, and then the number of faculty who have departed? You know, that will give us some idea about what are, because what you're telling us is that we have gotten zero increase in recurring dollars, right? So if there's zero increase, then what we need to do is to look at where are things, right? Is everything zero, or is the change zero in the number of faculty? So it would be good to know, you know.
What dates? People hired since when, and people who have left since when?
Since this, let's say, hired as of August, this fall.
And people that have left since August?
Why don't we just say the last academic year? So let's just say in the last academic year, the number of people that left and the number of people that were hired. just the last academic year, because we're just looking at the budget that we had for last year and then the budget that we'll have for this year. And so what we want to see is, where are the dollars? That's one way. And then, of course, there are other things that we will need to look at, but that's not, but just the number of faculty, because my understanding is that we haven't filled all positions. And so that would be something to look into. I may be wrong. Maybe we've hired more.
I think you're right that there are some unfilled positions at the institution. What if we try to do the following? What if we got headcount data by college for August 8th of 2024 and headcount data by college for August 8th of 2025?
Mm-hmm.
And you can see whether some colleges went up or down. You can still figure out what the net change is.
Does that suffice?
If we can
I think so basically, I'm looking at, and again, right, this is has come to us as a, even though you had prepared us for it, the email yesterday, but still. This comes as a surprise that there is basically no salary raises here. So then one has to figure out, where, if there were to be raises, where they would have come from. And that's why I'm asking for the information. Because this is as you mentioned yourself, almost all institutions got no increase, and yet.
I didn't say that. I said that preeminent institutions did not receive new recurring funding this year.
Right. That's right.
But
that's
let's
just talk about preeminent. And so one thing that maybe we should then have also clear then, so UCF did not make the preeminent status this year. Is that right?
UCF at this point has not been declared as preeminent. That's a decision that's made at the state level. That determination will be made. I've been at a couple of meetings where the president's made it very clear that we have made rather good progress over the last year.
I thought we had hit all the points, but okay.
Well, I mean, I think we may hear that sometime.
Mm-hmm. Okay. I do realize that even when you get it, it takes a year for the money to kick in. It doesn't come right away. Okay, so maybe we can get this about the number of faculty, so that gives us an idea, because there are also, what most of the time we're hiring faculty at the assistant professor level. So when we get this number, what would be really helpful is to get an idea of whether people were hired at a higher level. I would assume that most of them are assistant professors. And I think for the people who are leaving, my assumption would be that most of them are not assistant professors. There may be a few, but the majority would be associate or full professors. So again, if one takes a look at all of that, there's room to see, even with zero increment, where things could come in. So those are just, I wouldn't want to wait till next bargaining session to request this, but if we could get these numbers also by rank, that would be helpful. Then we can also go over, this is all public information, what is happening at other places, and then it's a question of how are they able to come up with funds that do provide raises.
We'll see what kind of data we can get on faculty numbers.
And you have the numbers. You know, you're aware of the raises that others have gotten, right? I mean,
I have some. I don't know for all the institutions.
I have them for all that we are interested in. Yeah.
And I know there are some. UF has numbers on both sides of the table. Right now, there's not agreement, as I understand it. And I believe that USF is not even bargaining until tomorrow, that they haven't done much. That's what I understand about that.
Yeah, but the offers are on the table at all of them. And you know, raise offers are at the table. So except for one institution, at all others that I'm aware of, the raise offers are at the table. They're either being accepted or being negotiated. But it's not zero. The raise is not zero, except for one institution.
Robert Talat, any other questions about our Article 23?
I don't have any.
Robert, I don't know what you may want to do right now. I can offer a couple of things. We are prepared to talk about the MOU on the internal advisory panel that you had given us some feedback on last time. I don't know if you would want to go into that right away or whether you'd like to have a caucus with your team and your membership. At this time, I'll leave it up to you what you think is the better way to proceed.
Let's get into the MOU.
Okay. All right. Charlie, we'll be putting that up momentarily. Thank you for going through the MOU that we had proposed to you two sessions ago. I actually think we're very, very close with this particular MOU. And I guess the incompetent person that edited this file didn't put the line numbers in, so I'm going to make this very hard on Charlie to walk us through this. But one of the things that we were asked to do is, you know, define what a step two reviewer is. Who is that? So we tried to do that here. And in the for clarity, I'm editing our original version one. I went back to what we had before, and I was working with that file. There's a question about, you know, who's a step one reviewer. In our original draft, sometimes we're referring to a university representative, sometimes to a step two reviewer. We've tried to make this very clear now that we're talking about a step two reviewer, because what we're talking about with this internal advisory panel is this panel could be called into action up until the point that the step two reviewer issues the step two decision. So the step two reviewer is really a key person here. And we've added a footnote at the bottom. And, thank you for putting those lines. I think it was on line 19, maybe before it moved, just as I was trying to read it. Yeah, there's a footnote by step two reviewer, and we've tried to define what a step two reviewer is. And it's a non-unit faculty member with an administrative role, such as, but not limited to, associate or vice provost, dean, associate dean, vice president, associate or assistant vice president, or chair director. And we say that a step two reviewer is selected based on experience, knowledge, as well as their availability to hear the grievance. So we try to find somebody that we think is good, knows what to do, and has the appropriate knowledge to work on that step two grievance. And they're also available to hear it. And then on lines, Charlie, going the wrong way. 27 and 28, just for additional clarity, we try to say, you know, if any of the terms of this MOU are not met, the grievance process will proceed only as it's outlined in Article 20 of the current CBA. Then in, that's just for clarity, on line 35, again, just saying we're talking about the step two reviewer. The university representative, we're taken out of here. It's the step two reviewer who is the key person in this particular process. Then as we go on to the next page, when the an IAP is requested, the UFF appoints two employees from the six, at least six that they've said are eligible to serve on an IAP, and the university will select a non-unit faculty member with an administrative role, so besides the step two reviewer. So it would be a person who is otherwise qualified to be a step two reviewer, but they're not this time, but they could have been. There's somebody else that we might use as a step two reviewer in other instances. With the addition of the statement about what the university is going to do in lines 40 and 41, lines 43 to 45 are no longer necessary. So we're suggesting that we strike those. And I know when we get to line 48, there were questions about, you know, is whenever possible, do we really want to say whenever possible there? And if I'm not characterizing that correctly, Robert, please help me out. But, you know, we're saying we could use language that shows up other places in the CBA, say whenever practicable. We think that that's a reasonable alternative. So I think we have to acknowledge that there may be some infrequent cases. They're going to be rare, where, you know, a complete elimination of any perception of conflict of interest is impossible. We in our office are very sensitive to conflicts of interest, and we do all that we can to avoid them. But there's a situation that came up a couple of years ago, for example, where the grievant was not represented by the UFF. The grievant was representing himself. And the grievant said the reviewer cannot be anyone who reports directly or indirectly to the provost. And you can see, if you look at what we've put in that footnote about a step two reviewer, that meant there are no step two reviewers that this particular grievant feels would have no conflict of interest. So, you know, we do what we can to keep the grievance process as conflict-free as possible. But sometimes it's to say that, you know, there's absolutely no possible perceived conflict of interest. I don't know that we can do that, but we try to do it whenever it's possible or whenever it's practical. In lines 50 and 51, again, we're striking the university representative from there. All that matters, the only person that matters here, is the step two reviewer. Similarly, in line 53, we're striking the university representative again. And finally, in line 63, we're striking the university representative. We just want to make it clear it's the step two reviewer. And that is the key person in this particular process. I know with the response to our first proposal that was shared with us, Robert, you had suggested that this MOU should be enforced until we have a new agreement. We're assuming that you mean a new full book CBA that would still be some time away. We hope that we get that done before August 31st of 2027, but we don't know. We like the language that says that this will be in force until August 31st of 2027. But if the UFF would be amenable to changing the language on language or the date through which the university can issue ADIs in the same way that they're suggesting here, we might be open to that, but we would not want to have this MOU be open until there's a new full book and lose the option to do ADIs on August 31st, 2027, even though I think we all hope that we have a new full book by August 31st of 2027. So in summary here, I think we're very, very close on this. One thing that you asked about, can we get a list of who the university might appoint? And we're saying all deans, all associate deans, all vice provosts, associate provosts, vice presidents, assistant vice presidents, chairs and directors, they're all candidates for this. We have a big list of people that could potentially serve as the administration's representative on an IAP. And we're only asking that the UFF provide us with six names. We've got many, many more than that. We hope that with striking the references to the university representative here and putting the emphasis on the step two reviewer, who is really a key person in this process, because we are approaching that step two decision date, that's really the key person. And we think we're doing a better job of emphasizing that with this draft. And then there may still be some discussion we want to have about that, the date, the sunset date for this MOU. But thank you for looking at our draft. Thank you for the thoughtful suggestions that you made. And I hope we've at least begun to address the points that you shared with us last time.
Can you put the MOU back on the screen, Charlie? I have a question about one of the things you added. Go down just a little bit. There. 27 and 28. If any of the terms of this MOU are not met, the grievous process will proceed only as outlined in Article 20 of the current CBA. So if the university doesn't meet one of the terms, does that mean that the grievous process will go as according to Article 20 of the CBA? This could be a yes or no answer, Chuck.
Well,
this sounds like it needs a little bit more wordsmithing.
I hear you. I understand completely the question, and it is our intention. We are the one that proposed this MOU. It would go forward. The university does not intend to not meet.
Right, but it's intention and in contract language, intention doesn't matter, right? It matters what's on the page.
The only thing the university has to do is get one person.
So can you answer my question in an academic way? So according to that line, if the university willingly does not meet one of the terms in this, can the university then turn around and say, okay, we're now going to go through Article 20 of the current CBA and not afford someone an opportunity for this? Could that happen with this language?
I think a very strict reading of that says, yes, that could happen.
Okay. Good to know. Thanks, Chuck. I'm good with the rest of it. We'll talk about it when our caucus meets next.
All right. Are there any other things that that you and your team want to talk about this afternoon, Robert?
No, I think we're good. Okay. Well, you don't have anything, do you?
No, we don't. I can tell you we have, you know, spent some time looking at the other MOU that you shared with us on the AI and digital workplace rights. We're going through that. We're not prepared.
All right. We understand that's a lot to digest, Chuck. So
yes.
We're optimistic that you're taking time and considering it and talking about it. That doesn't dissuade me from thinking that you're not taking it seriously.
No, we are doing that. Yes. And we will continue to do that. Okay. I guess we've accomplished our agenda for this afternoon. Our next bargaining session, I believe, is on October 8th. 8th. Yeah. So we will look forward to getting together again on October 8th. And if there are any questions that come up in between, that we should talk about. I know we won't do any bargaining, but if there's any clarifying questions that we want to ask, please get in touch with us. All right. Thank you, everybody.
Thanks.
All right. Bye-bye. Thanks, Chuck. Thank you, Charlie.
Thank you. See you. Bye-bye. Bye, Charlie. Bye, everyone. Bye, everyone.